A Valentine's Day special. We will be reading your Valentine's shoutouts to your friends and loved ones. So whether you are locked up or your loved one is, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, attention, Prison Pipeline. And email is kboopc@gmail.com. Then tune in and have your loved one tune in on Monday, February 13th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read live.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Skyline Tavern Project, a not-for-profit historic saloon at the edge of Forest Park dedicated to supporting art and ecology through live music, food, and horseshoes. 8031 Northwest Skyline Boulevard and skytav.com. Also by the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And here comes Stephanie with the Recovery Zone.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. This month, The Recovery Zone will be focused on the value of conservation efforts to protect nature, land, and biodiversity, what's been accomplished, the challenges that face these efforts, and now, with the Republicans and Trump at the helm, what we might be looking at. And, of course, what can we do? Guests include Glenn Lamb, Executive Director of the Columbia Land Trust, Alex Harris of Oregon Wild, and Jim Thayer, author of Hiking from Portland to the Coast, an interpretive guide to 30 trails. And you're the public lands coordinator, Alex, at Oregon Wild?
That's right.
Okay, public lands coordinator. And Jim is also on the board of the Columbia Land Trust. Your questions and comments will be welcome. The number here is 503-231-8187. Okay, so I wanted to just welcome all of you here. And we're talking about basically public lands, nature, and protecting it, and conservation, all of that. And probably we could talk about this for the whole hour, but I'd like to start with just each of you giving me a couple of reasons why this issue is so important for you. And maybe, Alex, we could start with you.
Sure. So here in the 21st century, we can assume that we've made a lot of progress on environmental issues. However, that isn't the case necessarily with public lands. We could see a lot of progress that's been made over the past 100 years actually rolled back. And that's a proposal not only by armed insurrectionists, such as the Malheur occupants 1 year ago, but also it's a proposal in legislatures across the country at the state level, as well as a proposal in Congress. And it's my goal to express the threat of public lands transfer and what that could mean in places like Oregon, where we have large swaths of federally protected land that's owned by all of us. However, that is not to say that it will always be owned by all of us. There is a proposal to transfer that land over to the states who could then use the land how they see fit, bypass federal regulations and whatnot to increase extractive profits, mm-hmm. And decrease public access.
Okay, and I definitely want to be getting into all that, but just you personally, Alex, why do you care so much about public land?
Yeah, well, I grew up in southern Oregon, a few miles outside of Ashland, one of the most beautiful places, I think, in the world. And I grew up recreating very often on public land. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about my place in the world while on public land. And I think that's a very unique opportunity that isn't given to most people in this country.
Right.
Out here in the West, we have that wonderful resource, and therefore we have a responsibility to take care of that resource and make sure that, that future generations can enjoy those same benefits that, that I've enjoyed.
And how about you, Glenn?
Thank you. Yes, great to be here. I really see that the Northwest is this vast fabric of beautiful lands, natural resource lands, nature, and it is both public and private lands. It provides our clean air, our clean water, our incredible wildlife, human health, relief for us all. It's built into our cultures, our native cultures, and our dominant culture today. The very sanctity of life on Earth, I think, is really reflected in this combination of public and private lands that we have here. And it's what's most central to our lives.
Yeah. And how about you, Jim?
Well, for me, I think that what really motivates me is the ability to be able to go out into the wild, into the forest, and to regenerate myself. And so I've been very concerned for a long time about maintaining and expanding that access, both on public and private lands. We're very lucky here in Portland to have something like Forest Park, which is an enormous reserve that people can use. But there's land beyond that, some of it that's owned by Metro, some of it that's owned by the timber companies. And the book I wrote is really about walking through all of those lands and being able to experience really the heart and soul of what Oregon is all about, which is these vast stretches of sylvan landscape that are, to the large part, empty. And it's a spiritual regeneration, and it's one that regenerates me every day.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, like when I think about it just myself, I end up with things like basically what Glenn was saying and both of you, in terms of just it gives you a spiritual connection to just something that's way vaster than just ourselves. But it's also, it's about our lives. It's like protecting it, you know, the bees for crop pollination, or water filtration, carbon sequestration for climate change. It's the air and the water that the air that we breathe. And then there's even these more subtle things like the rights of nature and beauty. I mean, there's just, to me, all these different things that protecting land is about. I guess it's like the carbon sequestration thing is an interesting part of it, because Oregon has so many forests. And Jim, I know that you had something on your blog about that, like how we could actually do something with carbon sequestration that would benefit us as well as the world. And could you just talk about that a minute?
Well, the current political leadership aside, we were beginning to move in a direction where I think that we were recognizing that there was a value to sequestering carbon, however we could do it. And oftentimes we would talk in these sort of broad generalities about the value of the Amazon to the overall atmosphere of the planet. Well, quite frankly, we live in North America's equivalent of the Amazon. And to the extent that we can, instead of valuing that land for its dimensional timber, we can begin putting a value on the carbon sequestration and see each one of those trees as a way to be part of a giant air conditioner, if you will, that provides us with clean air, then there may be a time when Oregon's entire economy will flip and it will become more important to see trees standing and see them accumulating lots and lots of sort of dirt and things on the branches, all of which is essentially carbon accumulation, and that there be a value in that. Mm-hmm. And if we get to a point where we're starting to compensate people for the use of the commons, if you will, the use of that atmosphere, we may actually begin to have a forestry that's devoted to trying to maintain and to optimize carbon sequestration instead of dimensional lumber.
Right.
And I think that would change Portland, change Oregon, change the Northwest in a fundamental way.
We'd finally go from like clear cuts to old growth forests again.
Right. And you would have you know, announcements by the Department of Forestry, not of the tallest tree, but of the tree that has sequestered the most carbon.
Right.
And it would be a...
We could celebrate those trees.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. I love
it. And we do to some extent. I mean, there are some huge trees. The Clutchy spruce down by Seaside was for a long time was the largest spruce in the world. Mm-hmm. And it was, unfortunately, it was hit by lightning and that was the end of that.
Right.
But it was celebrated for many, many years.
And then like one thing that I just really wanted to bring up because I had read it recently. There's a biologist out there. His name is E.O. Wilson. He's very old now, but he's written a lot of stuff. And he's just decided to go for it. He's got this radical proposal now looking at species extinctions, which we are now, as we know, in the sixth mass extinction, which means that plants and animals all over this planet are dying at a rate supposedly 1,000 times faster than the background rate. 41% of frogs and amphibians are either about to be extinct or are. And there's just a lot of stuff going on. Big land animals, I think 90% of primates are facing extinction. That's our fellow monkeys like us. It's a very insane kind of thing. And he says, okay, there's science, there's real hard science that says we could save 80% of this life if we would just cede 50% of the planet back to nature, kind of like World Heritage Sites. Somehow he has it figured out that people don't actually have to move. I think it would be something like land trusts. I'm not really sure what he's talking about. But I just was wondering if you guys could weigh in on that. Is that like a crazy idea, or is that something that maybe we should really be considering?
So this is Glenn. I mean, there's no question. Species rely on habitat.
Yeah.
There's no getting around it. The physical places are absolutely crucial. And increasingly, conservation groups are understanding and studying. Oregon has just completed a new comprehensive wildlife strategy, where here in Oregon, and Washington has a similar one, we have identified the most important habitat types that support the greatest variety of species. And so with that information in hand, we are now setting out to craft strategies with the public landowners and the private landowners in those areas to come up with collaborative solutions to protect that habitat and ensure that those species survive. So I think that the idea is right on. We have to protect this habitat in order to protect the species. And there are very clear strategies that we can develop that focus on the most important places so that we can achieve the kind of goal that E.O. Wilson has in mind.
And what kind of places are these? Or how would they, like where, for instance, here in Oregon?
I would encourage people to, there's maps that people can go to check online. The Oregon Comprehensive Wildlife Strategy, it's at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they have identified conservation opportunity areas across the entire state. A lot of them tend to run along our riparian corridors because water is such an important part of life. And but they're also in upland areas. They're in the east part of the they're across the entire state. And those are the areas that they have determined have the highest quality habitat value across the widest range of different habitat types. So coastal wetlands to alpine meadows. And they've done the analysis of all of those, and those maps are available online. You can even see, if you click on an individual conservation opportunity area, it will show you what birds and wildlife are in each one of those areas.
And what is that website again?
It's called the Comprehensive Oregon Wildlife Strategy, and it's the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. And so what's the deal then? Actually, Alex, maybe you could weigh in on this too. Do you think that's a realistic idea or
I'm not an ecologist, so I can't say for certain. I think it's very, very complicated. But just to echo the comments by Glenn, I would say it's important not only to ensure that the quantity of habitat that's protected increases, but also the quality and the proximity of that protected habitat to other areas that are protected. Animals need sometimes large areas to large corridors to roam and to live out their lives. And sometimes when we find protected pockets of land that are far removed from each other, that protected habitat isn't serving that purpose.
Right, it needs to have like a link to the other protected habitat.
That's right.
Right.
And so there actually are a lot of proposals that Oregon Wild is working on to link different wilderness areas and protected habitats. The Crater Lake Wilderness Area is one of those proposals where we're trying to link these disparate areas into a more coherent, protected swath of land. Mm-hmm. And that not only is important from a traditional ecology standpoint, but also from a climate resilience standpoint. As the climate continues to change, animals will need to move to adapt.
Right.
And if we do not provide those freeways and those corridors for animals to adapt to climate change, we will find that this extinction that's going on will only continue to go on.
And the problem with extinction is we're not immune. I mean, that's what it gets with me, is that human beings are also living animals on this planet. And if everything dies around us, I think it's insane for us to think that we can survive it. But anyway, I just want to let listeners know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. And this month, we're focused on conservation efforts to protect nature, land, and biodiversity. We have Glenn Lamb, Executive Director of the Columbia Land Trust, Alex Harris, Public Lands Coordinator at Oregon Wild, and Jim Thayer, author of Hiking from Portland to the Coast, an interpretive guide to 30 trails. You can call in with your questions or comments. The phone here is 503-231-8187. Glenn, I wanted to get back to you again. You had said that you wanted to talk about the importance of engaging people in knowing about and caring for nature. And could you just address that a bit?
Yeah, I'm a relentlessly optimistic person. And I believe that ultimately people will dictate what happens on our public lands. And obviously people are also controlling what's on our private lands. And there's a truism that people will protect what they love. They will love what they know. And they have to be connected to things in order to know them. And so connections to nature is absolutely crucial for me, following that chain from knowing it to loving it to taking action to protect it.
Absolutely.
And people have many competing interests increasingly in our society, technologically and otherwise. And we have more and more diverse cultures, and some people don't feel even included or invited in being able to get out to our public lands or to be able to get to them and have access to them. And so we must invest in growing nature awareness and connection to people from all walks of life. And it's very heartening to know that every Oregonian school child is now going to be able to attend outdoor school, thanks to a ballot measure that was passed last year. Friends of Trees here in Portland are out, spreading trees across our urban area. There's a backyard habitat certification program that's doing it.
I'm a part of that.
Wonderful.
But I have buttercups.
There's other groups. One of the things that I mentioned, all walks of life. There's other nonprofit groups in our area. Verde is one that's doing very innovative things to connect people from nature from different backgrounds. The Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon is a group that's identified at 82nd, Southeast 82nd to 205 Division de Powell is incredibly deficient in nature. And
right.
What they have been identifying through a jade greening project is that nature actually, that's one of the areas of our city that has the highest air pollution. It has so much traffic on all of those roads that I just mentioned.
Yeah, 205, 82nd Street, 92nd Street.
And nature helps to clean air. And, to have a park in that area that people could go to recreate and provide the benefits and to connect with nature that way. And so they have, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon has identified, in part through the connections to human health, the importance of nature in their area. So we're seeing an increasing number of efforts from an increasingly diverse community to connect people to nature. I want to offer, though, too, that we also have opportunities to connect with and support our rural communities. That's important, largely from a political landscape, that if you look at the voting patterns in our urban and rural areas,
really?
That there's been a real disconnect there. And we have reached out to a number of rural communities and constituents out there who, it's not surprising once you spend the time with people that in a lot of those rural areas, people care just as much about nature as in urban areas. But a lot of the political context around which they get engaged around nature is very different. And what we found is that taking the time to listen and build trust and respect in those communities allows us to come up with solutions that we never would have dreamed of. And long term, I believe that, getting back to my first point, people will dictate what happens on these lands. And by our making sure people in the urban area can connect and that we bridge this divide, urban and rural, that we can achieve that.
And I think some of that urban thing is, I thought one way into it, I mean the rural thing, is hunters and fishermen. We got two calls. Hang on a second. Well, who's our first caller? Jerry, do you want to weigh in on what's going on here?
I'd love to. I'm a third generation Oregonian and have a very deep seated love for this state, especially Southern Oregon and the coast. And it's an honor to be on your show, and I want to thank the gentleman for showing up and bringing this to the limelight, these very important subjects related to our public lands.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be in a position where I may be able to help with access to the Soda Mountain Wilderness area. I'm the head of a land steward that was created a while back. And we border the Soda Mountain Wilderness area. We also have the Pacific Crest Trail passing through one of our parcels. And the BLM policy has been to close roads because they don't have any money. And that's because the Bush administration basically cut the budgets for the BLM, especially in Southern Oregon and probably all over the country when he was in the White House. So I would certainly like to leave some contact information, especially for Alex Harris and Glenn Lamb, because we are very much interested in maintaining access for science and education into some of the most unique areas in the state of Oregon. And I have a feeling Alex Harris would agree that the Soda Mountain Wilderness area is fairly unique.
Okay, so our engineer said she'll get that information, but maybe you just want to leave a phone number real quick for other people too.
Yes, 503-236-1900. Yeah, we've been fighting the various interests down there, cattle interests. There was an eminent domain that was done back in 1968 that forced a road through our land that now runs along the Pacific Crest Trail. So we want to reverse things and restore things in this particular area, but we also want to provide access for science and education and create a launching area where field trips can be organized, and because the wilderness area down there is so unique. There's over 3,500 species.
It sounds like it's part of Glenn's save all kinds of animals with this particular land. Yeah.
It's one of the most unique riparian areas on the planet, and I want to thank Dave Willis, along with Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, for getting this latest expansion of the Cascade-Siskiyou National Monument signed by President Obama in the last week of his office.
Great. Alex, do you have a comment on all that?
That area is known for being especially biologically diverse. It's where the Siskiyou Mountains and the Cascade Mountains collide, and it's a tremendous area. That monument that was just designated is not necessarily safe. We've heard some somewhat scary comments from Trump's team on Obama's monument legacy. And we've actually also seen a proposal in Congress to change the mechanism that Obama used to designate so many monuments. That's the Antiquities Act. And Congress is considering to change that mechanism so that the president cannot unilaterally create those areas. So we should be thankful for what we have, but we should also acknowledge that there's a lot of work to do to make sure that these areas stay protected.
Yeah. And we had another caller. Ellen, Would you like to come in with your comment, question?
Yes, my name's Ellen Saunders, and I live in the Oregon Coast Range west of Portland, and I have been working on the spray issue for many, many years. I'm adjacent to Apple Valley Airport, and I would like to talk to someone about the ongoing toxic spraying of atrazine, 2,4-D, Roundup, and other toxic chemicals on our state forests, and what we can do to get legislation through. And I know I've talked to some of you people about this before. It's an ongoing issue.
Okay, and you want to comment on that?
I mean, this is an issue that goes way back to the beginning of what you might call the timber wars. The original incidents where they discovered that DDT essentially was being sprayed on the forest after it had been made illegal to use on any foodstuffs. It was still being used in agricultural, silvicultural uses. And there was a very famous case in a small little town called Alsea, where the local school teacher noticed that the women were having more births aborted and having difficulties giving birth, and did a study and showed there was a high incidence of that. That was eventually then shared with the Eugene Register Guard and became part of the sort of contentious relationships between the timber industry and local communities, because what was happening was the spraying was essentially being showered down on human residents because of the winds, etc. So this is an old issue that's been around for a very long time, and to the extent that we're using those kinds of
and still using them,
yeah, it is a problem, and it's a problem not just to people in general, but specifically also to women of childbearing age.
Right. I lived in Southern Oregon back in the 70s, and we were fighting that then. And you would have thought that would have finally been done, but it's not. Yeah. Well, thank you. I want to move on.
Can I just mention that the Beyond Toxics has a forestry pesticide project that if the caller, Ellen, if you hadn't yet connected to, that's one source that you could look into.
Beyond Toxics. Yeah. And I want to talk more about what is it, the threat of what's going on now with our public forests, and I'm going to have to take a little moment to, you know, for an ID break, but let's just start with that. Alex, I know that our public lands are, as you said, the Trump administration is starting to, like, he wants to get rid of the monuments that Obama established in his last days. But there's a huge thing going on called the land transfer movement, and I was wondering if you could start to talk about that.
Sure. So the main premise of the land transfer movement starts in the West. Out here in Western states, in a lot of these states, over half of our land is owned and managed by the federal government. Now, the federal government has a lot of different regulations and environmental protections, which we might argue are not strong enough, but they are quite strong in some areas. And state regulators, they know that. And folks, say, in Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, other parts of the West, they want to circumvent those regulations. And one of the ways they're going about that is proposing that the federal government transfer land from federal control to state control. And once states manage land, they're responsible for not only paying for the management, but also overseeing the management. That's a very logistically complex set of responsibilities that come with that land transfer. And these regulators know that. They know that they're not going to be able to adequately manage these large swaths of land. Their end goal, in a lot of cases, is to eventually sell off that land. And this threat is not hypothetical. It's actually right in front of us here in Oregon.
Well, something with Elliott.
That's right. Yeah. So we're here. We're seeing the state land on the Coast Range being sold off essentially to timber industries to be a timber company to be clear cut and used for extractive profit instead of staying public and continuing to serve all of the important public needs that it currently is, such as sequestering carbon or being a really important place for habitat. So that threat could expand if we were to see the states in the West gain more control of federal land.
And a little more about Elliott. Why is that actually happening? Why? How did that come around?
Yeah, it's actually quite complicated, and I don't want to get too deep into it. But it's related to Oregon's history of tying public funding for services such as schools to the extractive industry of the timber industry here in Oregon. And essentially, the state has got itself into this mess by essentially needing the revenue from that forest and not being able to fully comply with the environmental regulations in place while at the same time comply with their needs to meet the revenue that right. needs to come from that forest. So it's complicated. We could see this in other parts of the state if the state of Oregon is to gain control of federal land, which I should mention right now in this legislative session in Salem, we've seen a House joint memorial and a Senate joint memorial, two separate pieces of legislation that urge Congress to transfer federal lands over to the state.
And even in Oregon, where we consider ourselves green, we're ready to sell off our lands. Yeah,
that's right. And we're not sure if if these pieces of legislation will get much traction. However, in other states such as Utah, we actually have seen legislation passed.
Right.
And the state of Utah is preparing to sue the federal government to, they say, reclaim, even though they never owned the land in the first place, reclaim large amounts of federal land.
And that has to do, Utah, I mean, the whole thing with the new cabinet picks by Trump. But anyway, we'll get into that too, maybe. I want to let listeners know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. We're talking about conservation efforts to protect nature, land, and biodiversity. And I've got with me Glenn Lamb, Executive Director of the Columbia Land Trust, Alex Harris, Public Lands Coordinator at Oregon Wild, and Jim Thayer, who's author of Hiking from Portland to the Coast, an interpretive guide to 30 trails. And Glenn, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to add on the state-owned lands in Oregon and Washington, and Alex referred to the history of those lands, and a lot of those lands in both states were originally there to be revenue-generating properties for schools, for counties. And as such, we support a lot of those. I mean, we want counties, we want schools to succeed and everything else. Right. And there's a trust obligation that the states have to deliver to those interests. And so one possible solution to these, and the state of Washington has a very innovative program. They call it the Trust Land Transfer Program, where the legislature provides funding to acquire those trust lands that have the most ecological value so that they can be essentially the trust itself, the school or the county, whoever it is that the state is holding the land on behalf of. They get money from the legislature that they can go invest in some other thing, and the sensitive lands can then be transferred into an ecological protection category. So there's some ways that one-time appropriations from the state legislature can help to protect some of the most sensitive ecological lands.
And then how does that work in terms of actually, because I got the feeling that logging made money. And so is there, this gets transferred, it makes money for the schools at one point, but then does it continue somehow?
Well, if the property was currently forested, then what the legislature would do would be to have an appraisal done on the value of that land. So they would figure out how much value the trust owns. And then the legislature would appropriate that amount of money. Say it was $5 million. Right. They would appropriate $5 million. The $5 million would go to the school trust. Uh-huh. So the schools would be made whole, and they could go invest that money in whatever other way they wanted to. And then the property itself would be transferred into an ecological classification.
That's great.
And
Alex,
another benefit of that is that you can make payments on this over a long period of time instead of taking one big bite and saying we have to completely bail out the Elliott, which is a really large feat. It's
huge.
It's a very big deal. There's a reason there's a lot of opposition to that. But what Washington has done is allocate funding for these different swaths of trust land over a longer period of time, which is a lot more feasible for these state governments to do.
Wow. So there are ways to get around and work with this. And then ultimately, if we had Jim's carbon sequestration thing going, we would be getting money just for that, if we'd ever get around to realizing that was so important.
Eventually.
Right. But back to the whole land transfer thing, it's like a lot of us, you know, were just pretty upset about the Bundy takeover of the Malheur. And it's this idea of these radical militia groups that want to get land back. But I know that there's actually even more powerful interests that are like behind all that. And could you get into that a little bit, Alex?
Sure. So a great example of the connection between some of the more radical conservative players in the land transfer movement and the conservative establishment is Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brother group, which bankrolls a lot of conservative campaigns, and their connections to Ken Ivory, who's a state legislator in Utah. The Koch brothers' connections to Ken Ivory's group in Utah, which essentially seeks to transfer federal land to the states. We've also seen another example, even here in Oregon, the last legislative session to see a land transfer bill. That was 2015. We saw a bill introduced that had similar, if not exact, language from an ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, bill. And we've seen that throughout the West as well. We've seen ALEC supporting some of these more radical state legislators in their efforts to transfer land from the federal government to the state. So this isn't just a fringe movement. It was actually a part of the GOP platform this last summer. It was a big deal. A lot of conservatives were not on board with that decision, but essentially the GOP has now endorsed the idea that states need to control and manage more land. And we can guess why. They are getting to the edge of what they can extract on land currently available to them, and they want more.
So, and extracting means it's not just logging, it's also fracking, all of that. Is that kind of thing a threat here in Oregon?
You know, I think the biggest threat with fossil fuels is exports. We've seen a large amount of export proposals in the state that are essentially exporting coal, oil, and gas. And we've successfully defeated many coal proposals. Actually, six in Oregon and Washington over the past decade have been defeated. We've seen LNG proposals, three of them in the state of Oregon, that have been defeated. However, that threat is not over.
It won't let up.
In fact, the Jordan Cove Energy Project in southern Oregon, which was denied by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, is actually preparing to refile and go through that entire process again. And this has been a proposal for over 10 years.
Wow.
To build a 232-mile pipeline in southern Oregon, export fracked gas to Asia through Coos Bay. So these proposals could come back, and what happens in the Intermountain West with fracking definitely impacts us here in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, it just goes on and on. And Oregon Wild, what are you guys doing exactly to fight all this? I mean, what's your...
Yeah, well, a lot of different things. I mentioned the Crater Lake Wilderness proposal. That's been a big effort over recent years. I recently came on board as the public lands fellow at Oregon Wild to advocate for public lands and to ensure that we don't see mistakes like the 2012 piece of legislation in Utah, the State Lands or the Public Lands Transfer Act. We want to make sure that that doesn't happen here in Oregon. And essentially my role will be to encourage folks who use public lands, whether that's for hunting or fishing or backpacking, encourage those recreation enthusiasts to get active and plug in to ensure that these federal and state lands are protected from extractive interests.
Yeah.
That's a really important point. I think that For too long, we've taken for granted our ability to go out into the woods and enjoy what we think of as quintessential Oregon, the pastoral quality of our state. And we do really need to start looking at these things. To give you an example, our local regional government, Metro, has had a program for a long time to acquire lands for parklands. And they've been able, over the last 10, 15 years, to acquire about 17,000 acres of land that will, for example, extend the Wildwood Trail beyond the end of Forest Park. And a lot of parks sort of in the area of the Chehalem Hill, sort of the further extent of the urban area, if you will. That's 17,000 acres. Now, private timber companies, such as Weyerhaeuser, for example, can, at the stroke of a pen, if you will, can essentially require that anybody who goes in their properties pay $75 for a year's worth of access. And the only day in the year when they can actually get that is on May 18th.
That's the only day you can pay your $75?
It's the only day you can get it. And so with the stroke of a pen, they can put 212,000 acres off limits effectively, unless you paid those $75 on that day. And compare that with the 17,000 that all the goodwill and all the efforts of Metro have achieved. It's right. Great that they've done that, but it's a drop in the bucket right. Compared to what can be done at this large level. And that's an example of private timber interest doing that. Now, I'm not advocating that we should force timber companies to let everybody into their lands. It's private land, so they do have a choice. But there are more effective ways of doing it than the way they've done it, because it effectively only helps those people, for instance, hunters, who pay attention to dates and things like that, and who have an economic interest, because if they can bring out $800 worth of venison, they can pay for that, the cost of entering into that land. Hikers don't operate that way. And so as a result, they're essentially left out of the equation.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you had a comment.
Yeah, this is Glenn. I wanted to bring a collaborative side to looking at the question of public lands in these rural communities, and I want us all to put on our mediator's hat for just a minute and just kind of think, you know, there are people in Oregon's rural communities who are not associated with some of the groups that Alex referred to, or some of the national interest or the extractive resource interests. A lot of our county commissioners in our rural counties are people like you and me who have jobs and families and who are working in those communities and work in the schools and have kids and they want to help solve problems too. They're not just out to get whatever they can get. And Skamania County in Washington State is a good example, one here in our region in the Columbia Gorge, that more than 90% of that county is off of the tax rolls because of different kinds of public ownership. And a lot of their ability to provide core services to their people has been stripped away because so little of their land can they actually collect property taxes on. And historically, a large amount of income came from the receipts on the logging on the federal lands that were in Skamania County. Now, that has come to an abrupt halt. And one of the things that is been developed right now is that the U.S. Forest Service has developed what they call forest collaboratives. And these are efforts for people from all sides of the equation, from the environmental side to the local community side, to come together to say, it doesn't make sense to have all of the federal lands not have any management at all. And there is quite a bit of forest land out there that had been planted in plantation that thinning activities, even if your goal was to get to old growth forest and that's all you were doing, that it would be very valuable to be having some forest management activities on land right now. And these forest collaboratives are intended to provide an avenue through which that kind of forestry activity could occur on properties, and it could provide some relief to the local communities to have some jobs and some income that flows back to those communities. So I just want to point out that there are some collaborative efforts that are being made. that I think will have some benefit, for instance, in Skamania County in Washington State and Klickitat County even further east. They're two counties that have historically fought conservation proposals in their counties. But we have, Columbia Land Trust has spent the last 15 years building relationships, listening to what their local concerns are. And now in both of those counties, when I think back on any conservation proposal we've brought forth in those counties in the last few years, the county commission has written letters of support for our projects, because they feel like, here's someone who came out here and listened to our story and our plight and who helped us problem solve around how we can solve our issues. And again, it's like I said earlier, in our rural communities as well as our urban communities, people have a connection to nature. We're from the Northwest, and a lot of these landowners, that's a part of who they are. And if we can approach them and identify that on their own terms and help them find solutions that they can live with and that support them, there's some real hope.
Huh, that sounds beautiful. And so basically, this is the kind of work then that the Columbia Land Trust is doing.
Yes, we reach out directly to private landowners, ranchers, foresters, people who've owned property for generations, tribes, and we build these kinds of collaborative agreements.
Uh-huh. And I want to get into that a little bit more. Again, I want to let listeners know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone. This is KBOO Portland. We're focusing on conservation efforts to protect nature, land, and biodiversity. My guests are Glenn Lamb of the Columbia Land Trust, Alex Harris, Oregon Wild, and Jim Thayer, author of Hiking from Portland to the Coast, an interpretive guide to 30 trails. You can call in with your comments, 503-231-8187. And what exactly, again, does the Columbia Land Trust do? Does it it actually buys up land and then locks it away, is the idea?
Well, our mission is to conserve the vital lands, waters, and wildlife through sound science and through strong relationships in the communities here where we operate. And to be sure, some of our work is accomplished by acquiring land and owning it and managing it for all time. We tend to not think of ourselves as locking up land. Our land is often available for hunting and fishing, bird watching. We're not a parks department, so you won't see us developing parking lots and restrooms and trails. But if we've helped to acquire property that is very appropriate for public access, you may see us even turning land over to such a park agency in order for them to be able to provide that sort of access.
But you're turning it over to a park agency, and then if Alex is right, the park agency decides to sell it off or something.
Right.
Is there that concern?
Yes, there absolutely is. And typically with every property that we've protected, anything that gets transferred has a deed of right and legal protections that go with it that indicate that there's a third right of third-party enforcement to ensure that if that property were ever sold, a property of equal value would need to be protected in some other way. So it's not foolproof, but we definitely are aware of that and have been working towards that. But I just wanted to add, and you wanted to know a little bit more about what we do and how we do it, the collaborative approach that we would take. So 50%, we'll say 50% of our forest land is public forest land. So that means 50% of our forest land is private ownership. Of that private, so half of what we're talking about here is in private ownership, and half of that private ownership in the Northwest, in Oregon and Washington, is in the hands of family forest landowners. Mm-hmm. So these are people that tend to own 200 acres to maybe 2,000 acres. These are not industrial forest landowners, Weyerhaeusers or Plum Creeks or anybody else. These are families. And a lot of these families have always had in mind that they would continue to manage it in a sustained fashion for forestry activity. And they've had hopes that the next generation will come in and keep it property from ever being developed and will keep it in forestry. But a lot of those family forest landowners are facing some very unique challenges right now. A lot of the younger generation is not continuing to participate in forestry activities. They've moved away, gone to college, and are not coming back. The owners are getting older and are not as able to manage that land any longer. A lot of the regulations around forestry offer up the opportunity for habitat conservation plans that protect endangered species, but it's very expensive to prepare those habitat conservation plans, and a lot of these family forest landowners can't afford to do that. So what we are doing, that this is an example of the kind of thing Columbia Land Trust is reaching out to, that class of landowners, and they're represented in both Oregon and Washington basically by small woodlot owners, and in Washington it's the Washington Farm Forestry Association, and we're working with them to identify what those challenges are that might cause landowners to convert their land to houses or anything else like that, and say, what can we do to support you in keeping your land from ever being developed and keep it in natural resources? So we're a real problem-solving, collaborative reach out there. Give you just a few examples of hope. There's a man who is from an Oregon timber family who had mills in the Willamette Valley, and who now, as he's getting along in life, he's decided that he's very interested in donating funds to help identify and protect a forest that would just be nature, old growth for all time. We have two or three families that have contacted us right now that are so focused on wanting to conserve their land that they're talking about outright gifts of forest properties that would keep it in forestry. There's a young man who's the son of it's fourth or fifth generation of Oregon Forestry Company, who went back to Yale, got his degree there in forestry, and is now out here helping to come up with strategies to help solve this kind of problem.
So if a combination of that and our public lands, we might be able to really hold on to E.O. Wilson's, protect it all and keep a lot of things going. But
one thing to keep in mind, this is Jim, when you're talking about the split between public lands and private lands, it also divides out geographically to some extent. It's not completely so. But much of the Cascades, you're dealing with federal lands, you're talking about state lands. When you get into the Coast Range, you're talking about mostly private ownership and some state ownership. So the actors in these different areas are different. And again, the Coast Range is also very important for us because it is the densest forest in the world, from the Columbia, the Olympic Peninsula.
Denser than the jungles in the Amazon.
Yes, wow. Yes. It, per cubic foot. Well, I mean, consider it. You stand in if I stand in the Coast Range and I look up, I'm looking at a tree that's 250 feet high.
Right.
So that adds to your statistical cubic mass, if you will. But if you've ever tried to bushwhack through the Coast Range, it's near on to impossible. But these lands are so important in terms of feeding the rest of the ecosystem. If you log off too much land on these very, very sensitive coastal lands, you end up not being able to absorb as much moisture, and it eventually prevents water from transferring to the interior of the country as far deep as 400 miles. So much of the meteorological impact on the interior of Oregon comes from practices that we use on the coastal range. So the coast range is a very, very important area. And it's also very hard hit by some of the stuff that Glenn was talking about. I mean, these are areas that used to have just absolutely enormous incomes from timber sales. But all that timber's gone, and a lot of that activity is no longer providing revenue. So we also need to consider how do we maintain not just the actual forests, but the Oregon lifestyle of living in the country, being able to exist in a small community like Vernonia. These are very, very important things. And from my standpoint, I see recreation as being part of the solution to that. So, for example, the mayor of Vernonia was the one who started this effort to create a trail that went all the way from Vernonia to Banks. It's a very, very successful trail. That was something that he was involved in. He's now also developed a trail from Vernonia all the way to Scappoose. Huge effort. These are all things to get people out into nature to understand that, but also to some degree to bring economic development to some of these smaller communities that Glenn was talking about.
And part of that is that there, money can be made. I mean, maybe we're not making so much from logging, but we could make money off the recreation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, when you asked how Columbia Land Trust is addressing this, the second part is that we are engaging people. The Backyard Habitat Program that you're enrolled in is managed by Columbia Land Trust and by the Portland Audubon Society in partnership. And there's now nearly 4,000 families in Portland that have joined you in improving the habitat in their own backyard. And there are some absolutely compelling stories of families and kids connecting to nature and hummingbirds and owls and all kinds of inspiring things that are causing to people to get more involved. And as we head towards the end of the hour here, I just kind of wanted to point out that, as I said at the outset, people will dictate what happens on our lands, and I urge you to help get involved in both connecting to nature personally yourself, but also to encouraging others to as well.
And connecting to nature personally, that again goes back to Jim, because this is the book that you wrote, basically, hiking from Portland to the coast. And what was that kind of your motivation?
Well, this actually goes back to something that we first talked about among the Friends of Forest Park, of which I was a member of and actually co-founder of that organization. And we had talked about trying to figure out how to connect Forest Park with the coast, both because it physically would be fascinating to be able to do that, but also because, again, it's connecting people in the urban areas who identify with Forest Park, but getting them to identify with the larger expanse all the way out to the coast. And so I ended up writing a book called Portland Forest Hikes, which was an examination of some of the less known trails in Forest Park, which left me at the end of that book standing on a hillside up above Scappoose going, I need an excuse to be out here on the weekends or I'm going to get in trouble with my wife. So I thought, I remembered this project that we had worked on. I said, well, you know, we commissioned this feasibility study and it identified three different routes. One was the water route, which Lewis and Clark used, and two were these suspiciously straight dotted lines going through the mountains. Why, if you know anything about the Coast Range, nothing goes through it in a straight line. It's not possible. And so I said, well, let me go and figure out what they really are. So I spent 7 years basically walking the entire a swath all the way from Portland to all the way to the coast. And this is really an effort to get people to understand. I was very much involved in the early part of the development of the Salmonberry Trail, which is a project that's probably going to take about another 20 years to complete. It'll probably cost, you know, $50-60 million to do over that period of time. But when it's done, it'll be literally one of the world-class rail-to-trail conversions anywhere in the world. And it's absolutely fabulous country and very, very dramatic. And it's something that's part of our heritage here that we should be able to enjoy. Yeah. And that's what I was trying to essentially to open people's eyes to how you can get there on a day hike, how to do a loop hike in some of these areas that are really quite extraordinary.
How to get out there and get to know it and get to love it.
Yeah, and you see both sides of it. You also see the clear cuts as well. But
right.
Again, we should be aware of what's going on. We shouldn't be just driving down Highway 26 and with a green
where
curtain.
Where they keep a little curtain for you. Right.
Get out there and look
and
at it.
And realize what's happening. And the other thing, you said it costs $60 to $65 million, but I was talking with you earlier and you were saying that it brings back, what, two or three times that for the people in those areas?
The economic development numbers that were developed by the Department of OPRD, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, showed that there was about, if I recall, something like a 4-to-1 return on investment for the parks that they developed in terms of bringing money into the local communities. It was a huge input for them. And you can see it. If you go to Banks, which is at one end of that long linear trail that I was talking about, you've got a bike shop there. You've got all kinds of places where you can go have coffee, have lunch.
Like Hood River's gotten like that.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's part of an economic development strategy we should be pursuing that has benefits both financial, but cultural, but also for the forest itself.
Totally win-win. So we're running out of time, but do people have last words before we end?
I did look up, and it's OregonConservationStrategy.org is the exact webpage address where you can identify the most important conservation areas that have been identified by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife and the habitat types and the species types that they've targeted for protection.
Wow. So that's a really good thing to check out. And how about you, Alex? Was there anything you'd like to say?
I would just say anybody who regularly goes outdoors and enjoys public land has a responsibility to advocate for that public land. And especially in this time when we're seeing a lot of change on the federal and local level, That change won't be positive change unless the people are involved.
Right. And I just want to mention something that I heard just on Paul Rowland's show earlier this morning. There's a group out there called IndivisibleGuide.org or dot something or another, Indivisible Guide. And they have come up with their how the members of Congress were so influenced by the Tea Party, and they're saying that we can do the same thing and we can actually do it kinder. But it sounded like a really good website for how to take action and how we can organize ourselves to do that. And but you, Jim, do you have last words for us here?
Well, I'd like to just second Alex's point. I think that it's important to get out and to enjoy the woods for your own sake, but I do think it's also very important to get involved in a way that you could actually make a difference. That's why I'm part of the Columbia Land Trust. That's why I was very intrigued, especially the Columbia Land Trust, because they also, you mentioned earlier, that they also support family forestry and family farming. And this is, again, speaks to the retention of the rural lifestyle and that we don't lose that part of our heritage. And I think I really enjoy the, and I believe it's effective, the collaborative approach. So get involved with right. an organization that you believe in.
And basically get involved. A march is great, but we got to work a lot harder.
That's right.
Okay, so you've been listening to Glenn Lamb, Executive Director of the Columbia Land Trust, Alex Harris of Public Lands Coordinator Oregon Wild, and Jim Thayer, author of Hiking from Portland to the Coast. This has been The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. I want to thank Tammy for her great engineering, and thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for our Youth of Color Production Internship Program. This internship is open to people of color attending college and or under the age of 30. This is a 6-month internship for 20 hours a week for $20 an hour. Responsibilities include the selection and preparation of KBOO content for national distribution using a variety of digital audio workstations and helping to develop a digital content strategy for promotion of KBOO content. Deadline to apply is Friday, January 27th at 5 p.m. More information, including skills and qualifications, can be found at kboo.fm/productionintern2017.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Fix-It Fair, starting at 9:30 a.m. on Saturday, January 28th at George Middle School in Portland. Fix-It Fairs bring people together to learn simple and effective ways to save